I'd like to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education, and it is such a pleasure to be a part of this program. Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing series with artists, art scholars of all stripes here each week. We have only a few more, so I encourage you to get online and see what the lineup is. I also want to use this opportunity to remind you that we're still doing the Sundays with the Modern, which is an ongoing tour series where we have artists and art scholars come and talk about special exhibition, the aspects of the architecture, permanent collection. It's a real treat, and it happens every Sunday at 1 p.m., We meet, you can ask at the info desk where we're meeting. We'll either be at the top of the stairs or at the bottom of the stairs. And it is free with the cost of admission. So making it free, of course, for members, and free on the first Sunday of each month. I also want to remind you of the final graduate student lecture. We've been announcing those each week. The last one will be this Saturday. So I encourage you, if you've gone to any of them, you know how good they are and how nice it is to encourage graduate students in this program by attending. So I invite you to do that as well. You'll find that information online. Next week for the Tuesday evening series, we have Jerry and Jean Jones. We'll be here visiting with our chief curator, Michael Opping. They're going to talk about the Joneses' art collection and specifically the choices they made for the Cowboy Stadium's state-of-the-art collection. And I have to say, I saw that today, and it is, in fact, a state-of-the-art collection. It is a collection that, of course, includes the work of tonight's speaker. And as you are fully aware, we are an incredibly, incredibly fortunate group of people because tonight we get to hear from one of the pioneers of the conceptual art movement of the 1960s. With his 1968 statement of intent, Lawrence Wiener revolutionized contemplation, using language as material for subject, defining art as representation of relationships in the physical world. In his own words, the relationship of human beings to objects and objects to objects in relation to human beings. And then there are, in addition to, of course, the fact that language is sculpture in this case, there are the unromanticized implications of the words and the relationships that he chooses. It's such a bold and meaningful contribution, and it has, of course, been recognized with international exhibitions that actually boggle the mind. I believe the solo exhibitions were 26 pages long. So if we're going to get to Lawrence's lecture tonight, I'm not going to run through them. He has participated in Documenta 5, 6, and 7, as well as 2005 and the 2007 Venice Biennale, and the 2006 Biennale Sao Paulo. His many honors include the 1976 and 1983 NEA Arts Fellowships, a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1994, the Wolfgang Hahn Prize of 1995, and a Skowhegan Medal for Painting Conceptual Art in 1999. In 2007, the Whitney Museum of American Art had the great insight to organize an absolutely brilliant retrospective titled As Far as the Eye Can See. That exhibition traveled to the MoCA in L.A. in 2008. I hope some of you got to see that exhibition. It was, in fact, remarkable. An exhibition for which Roberta Smith of the New York Times called A Wake-Up Call and Purification Rite All in One. And I think she hit the nail on the head. And the list, of course, goes on and on. He is currently working on a book and, if I understood, a film. And this year he has a show in Utrecht in the Netherlands and in Zurich. And he's currently working on an exhibition at Marion Goodman, which opens in December. I cannot believe he accepted my invitation to be here tonight, but I could not be more grateful. And of course, there is the wonderful one lump, two lump, three lumps, four that belongs to this museum and is in this collection. You're familiar with it, having been in the cafe where it was beautiful, and being the gracious artist that he is. Lawrence, in fact, loved that sighting. And as I understand, he also approves of the new siding, which is in Gallery 5. And I invite you to go see it because, as I said, it's kind of interesting, the implication of relationships and how those words seem to take on perhaps a different meaning in a different location. And, of course, that piece brings me to tonight's talk because Lawrence has titled his presentation tonight, One Lump, Two Lumps, Three Lumps, Four. He's going to, I believe, show us some very special films and talk to us about his ideas and the things that interest him. I said I can't imagine a better evening. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Lawrence Weiner.
Well, I'm afraid you probably know everything about me now. There's not much more to say. I don't know. What the role of the artist is within our society at this time, we've reached a very strange state where I'm a useful human being. I don't find what I have to say not interesting. But I'm much more useful if I can talk about things that other people are curious about, because I've had this very lucky sort of situation. I entered into the art world at a time when the art world was developing itself within the United States in the late 50s. And there was no school systems in that time, really. There were some places, but those were genuinely for privileged people, essentially. So the rest of it was lacking any kind of a structure and completely dependent upon the generosity, as Tennessee Williams did in his autobiography, The Generosity of Strangers. I don't know where I'm supposed to begin tonight. I brought a little cartoon. I got an award from the BAFTA. The BAFTA is the British Academy Awards for design and things. I make movies as well. And this was for design and for other things. And I didn't know, again, what I was supposed to do to get up, to break the ice, to get to the point of having a conversation with the people who've come. So I made a little cartoon, and it's a kitchen table cartoon. And it's 5 minutes. And if you'll bear with me, we'll just run the cartoon, and then afterwards, perhaps, the conversation can begin. Would you be kind enough, number one, please? As I realize how many other speakers have been. A few proposals as to why we are all here and perhaps as to where we're all going are in order. Roma, can we please have some music? Art is not a metaphor upon the relationships of human beings to objects and objects to objects in relation to human beings, but a representation of an empirical existing fact. It does not tell the potential and capabilities of an object, material, but presents
presents a reality concerning that relationship. Constant placation of previous aesthetics consumes present resources to the extent that as the needs and desires of a present aesthetic make themselves felt, the resources have been exhausted. Present aesthetic, that's us. Reality is no different than any other reality. It is the content that gives the perceptions and observations of an artist within the presentation art a use factor within the society. The acceptance of the need for this distancing by a society, in fact, the need itself by a society for its art to function, has led to the misconception that art and artists are apart from society unless they do not function as artists. There are very few material relationships of human beings to objects that at various some stages have not required various some form of human being to human being relationship. The utilization of media presents these various relationships at the moment of the presentation of what, in essence, is a material relationship. The utilization of media as both presentation and representation seems to require no justification other than the presentation itself. Change in the relationship of art to a culture is perhaps that the explanation, the not needed justification, of the existence of art has been allied to the concept of production. This reading, while obviating some form of social unease, is not in fact the case. Art is in relation to its society a service industry.
I thought that that probably would cover giving some sort of sense of where I stood. There is a difficulty for artists as they get long in the tooth. You've participated in things, you've done things, and it all begins to build up as if it's an authority. And that's not the situation that I find myself in. I think I know what I'm doing most of the time. But I never taught, even though there were economic reasons for doing it. Because one of the things a teacher really must do is take on the responsibility of the students and have authority. And one of the few things that I can't do as an artist is have authority. I've been working for the last 4 or 5 years on a body of work that has to do with the idea of multiple realities. That there is no Aristotelian logic based into our world, that in fact there is no parallel realities. When there's a parallel reality, it's always something is a shadow of something, something is a reflection of something, something is not quite right. If there's multiple realities, and the old thing of how many angels can dance on a pinhead, you don't have to have a hierarchy. That what happens at this moment, here and there and there and there, is happening at the same time, at the same point of time, and probably in the same place. And if that's so, this non-hierarchical idea of material, that lead is not better than steel, and steel is not better than oil paint, etc., leads one to a point where the logic structure we are imposing and we're presenting to the world does not allow for most of the things that go on in the world. There cannot be a hierarchy. My difficulty in a talk like this is that I've been a lucky person. I've been able to put the work out in the world. And that does the talking for me. I don't have any soap to sell. People like, we're talking, I think, what is it, 50 years ago? Yeah, it's a long time ago. How long? 40 years, 45 years. When there were a lot of artists showing work that didn't quite fit in at the time. That's a very long time ago. And you can't talk about anybody as being sons of the pioneers or things like that. You can't talk about that because it doesn't make any sense. What happened was there was a change in a mentality. And that mentality meant that art was about the relationships of human beings to objects. It was about now. It's not about then. I just had to do a little talk with the people from the Cowboys Stadium because I did a piece there. And they were talking about past, present, and future. And I realized I don't believe in the present. I have no idea what it means. By the time I'm talking to you or you about it, it's the past. I can believe in the future, but I really don't care about that. I don't know what I care about at this point as an artist. As an artist, your relationship to the world is almost to lay things out for people and, in fact, help them to find their own place in the sun by realizing their relationships to objects. If I'm to be of any use, I have another cartoon with me, but I'll show it a bit later. If I'm to be of any use to anybody here, as an artist, and I'm pleased and proud to be an artist, it really would be to be talking about things that interested the people who are here would be a conversation. Lucy Lepard, a very good critic, very nice person, she's living in this area nowadays, as far as I know, somewhere around Santa Fe, which is all part of the Southwest. But she was, well, it is, I'm sorry, I'm from New York City. I was born and raised in New York, and I keep a foot in Amsterdam because I wanted my daughter to grow up with a foot in the old world and a foot in the new world. But she once went up in front of an audience, and it was sometime in the 60s. She stood there, and at that moment she was this hotshot critic, and there she was, and she looked at the audience and said, "Any questions?" And there were none. I could do that too. But I'd like to say, are there any questions? Everybody's here because they have some vague idea of what I've done or who I am. And as I said, with the internet nowadays, everybody knows what everybody's done, more or less. I have seen things of mine on YouTube that maybe I'm getting old, but I don't remember having made. Some of them were even sort of interesting. But if I'm here, and I am, why don't we look for somebody with a little bit of courage and ask some questions and start a conversation, and maybe we can turn it around. I have a lot to say about a lot of things, but I don't quite know where to start. I don't have a formal lecture. I mean, I can give you one if you like about Aristotle and the idea of Aristotelian logic not quite working, and let's take the bagel from Hegel. It all sounds very good, and in fact, it makes a lot of sense. But I'd much rather be of some use. I saw a hand. Oh, Michael, of course. In-house shill.
I guess what I would like to ask is, where, on a basic level, where the language comes from? And you could say, well, the language comes from the culture. I'm just going to sort of ask a question and fall off a cliff and try to make some wings in a question while I do it. But Dan Graham has said that conceptual art is really a sort of an outgrowth of pop art in the sense of vernacular imagery, and in your case, perhaps vernacular language. And I guess my basic question is, does the language come from the material you refer to, or does the language come from a kind of vernacular that you hear in the world? Does that make any sense?
Oh, it makes sense, but you're asking me to tell you where something comes from. I can only tell you why I use language and what the decision was. You can't see anything. You see this. Everything you see in the world, you give a name to. It has every culture, every country, it has a name. But a piece of wood in Senegal and a piece of wood in Tokyo and a piece of wood in Scandinavia doesn't look the same, but in fact it's a piece of wood. At the time I began to try to make art, I was involved in meeting people who basically knew exactly what they were doing. And they were special. When their hand touched something, it became special. And I'm terribly sorry, maybe it was a vulgar, crude person, but I didn't see the special. I saw stone, steel, iron, wood. And some of it was exciting and some of it was not. The use of language frees you from that. All children see things and give them names. Dan Graham's speaking about so-called pop art, so-called conceptual art. That may be fine for Dan Graham, but my relationship with pop artists at the time in the 50s was really, I was really quite enamored of their skill as painters, and I found them quite intellectually interesting people. Nothing to do with what I do. It was a coexistence, again, simultaneous at the same time. I don't see things as outgrowths. That would be a strategy. And we can always go back to paraphrasing Janis Joplin. Strategy is just another word for nothing else to lose. Strategy, we're now at the most complicated time of contemporary art in the Western world that we've ever had. Art has been taken out of the hands of people trying desperately to set up another logic structure, and has been taken over by the academy. And the problem with that is not that the academy is evil or there's anything particularly right or wrong with it. The job of the academy is to give answers, and at the very least to pose solutions. The job of artists is to ask questions. They're totally antithetical. They don't have anything to do with each other. The role of art is to pose things by presentation, not imposition, to people that pose questions. I was asked to be on an interview once when I did the manhole covers in New York City, and that's in direct line with another and the next, and there's 19 of them. There were supposed to be 20, but the people installing them came banging on the door of the studio, scaring the life out of an assistant of mine, and I was traveling, and said, there's the guy who did this, he lives here, yeah. And there was this big greasy thing hanging there, and they said, yes, and they said, well, it's a good project, he ought to have one of them. And they started to clean it, and they left it there, and it weighs 350 pounds. But New York One was asking me questions, and it was cable, the beginning of cable in those days. You could say anything you want, so your language was not a problem. And they said, you know, look, we know you, you're an angry person, you're a New York person, you're involved in politics and civil rights, da-da-da-da-da. Why is this so quietly laid just in the street? And I had to think. I didn't have an answer. And I realized that I was becoming furious with most of my colleagues who thought they had the right to run out in the street and do things to people. And it's public. So as public art, I realized that I don't want to fuck up anybody's day on their way to work. I want to fuck up their whole life. And if that's not a reason to make art, I don't know what is. that, I mean, it's very hard. I'm standing here. I'm not running for public office. Thank heaven I'm not looking for a job, which at this time, day and age, is a major concern. But I really and truly think that the whole purpose of making art, the only reason we should be doing it, is to be placing things into the world that pose logic problems for people, that make people question their own sense of their own value in their own world, the world that they can see and they can touch. Artists make things that people can see and that people can touch. My using language does not take it out of that realm of seeing, touching, and otherwise. It's just another aspect of it. The sensuality is there. Art is essentially sensual. When it ceases being sensual, it becomes illustrative, becomes illustration. I loved illustrated books when I was a child. I loved classic comics. You could get the whole story, and then you could read the language, and you didn't even have to pay attention to the story anymore. You could just get into the language. But that's still just illustration. And that's maybe not what art's about. But I think we need another question than Michael's. Does anybody have anything that they're curious about? Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about, well, first of all, with the multiple realities that,
yes,
that you're interested in now, I'm interested in that process of you coming to a realization or recognizing something that you've always known, or in both now with the multiple realities and also at the moment when you realize that many colored objects placed one after the other,
placed side by side to form a row of many colored objects.
When you realize that that was sculpture and that that was, I know you're not one to receive compliments, but that was a pretty profound moment when you began to use language as material and present that work as sculpture. Can you talk about those two moments of kind of coming to that realization that language could be a material for sculpture, and the moment that you're in now where you're realizing that it's this multiple reality, and maybe how are we as, I mean, how are we going to handle that, being that we don't appreciate chaos? You know,
multiple realities have nothing to do with chaos. Multiple realities have to do with the reason for making any form of art. It's to enhance and give dignity to objects and materials. It's nothing whatever to do with chaos. Chaos has to do with another set of questions. Chaos theory, in fact, doesn't have anything to do with chaos. Chaos theory is trying to figure out why it's so warm now, and could it really be a wind farm that's taking away the roof? Nobody gave any dignity. Okay, my generation, and I hate the word, by the way, generation. If you're standing on a street corner and you have to cross, I've said this before, you have to cross the street, and there's somebody that's 90, 80, 70, all the way down the line, and you make it across the street without getting hit by the bus, you're all in the same generation. It's that simple, and that's for artists, for everybody else. Artists' reality is no different than anybody else's reality. We're not special people. We've just chosen to spend our time looking at other things as mathematicians have, as dental researchers have, as anybody has. But this thing about wanting to know where the primacy comes, it was not so complicated. You have to take it out of a concept when there was a market-driven concept of the new, and look at it in terms of a lot of people not quite sure what it was. We were talking earlier today, and what came up was a funny thing. I grew up at a time in New York City And because I worked on the docks at night when I was a kid, I hung out in bars and I met a lot of abstract expressionist painters and a lot of other people. So my entrance into the world was not just people like myself trying to screw the world or do something. There was no upsetment when I even finally was taken into legitimate places to show. It was only the frightened people, all the people that were doing something, were saying things like, hey, kid, you know, everybody says you're out of your mind, but you're not out of your mind, but how are you going to make a living? That was their only concern. There was no hatred. There was no violence until we got to the graduate school with people. Once they started pumping them out, then there was competition. Art's not about competition. Art's about being right and being wrong. It's that simple. And art is a profession. You go up on a wire. And if you're wrong, you fall down. And you get hurt. And if you're right, you get to the other end of the wire. And do you know what that does? That lets you talk to the other people and make something new that got to the other end of the wire. Art does not essentially give you anything that you don't already have. It helps you to place it within a context of your life. I make art that has no metaphor. None of the works of mine have a double meaning. In language, you can make double meanings out of things, but then you look at what it's saying it's making. There's no double meaning whatsoever. Anybody coming to it from any culture, which was one of the reasons, Michael, that I chose to use language, I had decided that I wanted to make art in the world, not just in New York City or Los Angeles. And in doing that, you don't make something with a metaphor. You let people come to art who have needs and desires and trying to figure out their own place in the world and bring their needs and desires, and they make a metaphor out of what you have made. If you have a metaphor, each succeeding group of people that find your work, I'm trying to avoid using the word generations, then does not have to accept your value structure in order to use it. Doesn't have to accept your logic structure in order to use it. Doesn't have to accept your lifestyle in order to use it. You are putting out something. There is a generosity to the making of art. You're trying to destroy what you're seeing. And I'm convinced that all art is made from anger. You are very angry. One is angry with the configuration that's presented to you of the world, the way things are read and done. And in that anger, you try to build another configuration, but without the anger against the configuration, if you're just doing it to enter into another so-called line of things that might have worked maybe a year after Giotto, but it didn't work afterwards either. Art has continually presented not other realities, but other means of using reality. And I think I'm going to show another cartoon for 5 minutes, if nobody minds. It's this one that it's going to be in a show that I'm doing in New York now, and we've just finished it. And I brought it only because there's a movie I just did for Anna Sanders in Paris, and they just had to negotiate to get the rights to get part of this little cartoon that we're going to show. So do bear with me for 5 minutes. May I have the second one, please? It's silent, so you can chatter with each other. So you're my Toronto. There's always, when you have a film that you're not quite sure, a film, they show it in Toronto to see how it works. That's where my mind is right now. I'm trying to determine. But as far as all of this leading up to, let's pose some funny little questions. Why was it possible for somebody making work like I was making in the late 60s to be hanging next to a Robert Ryman, to be showing next to this? Why was it possible for me to be showing with a Chamberlain, with a this one, with a that one? Why was it not exclusive, and why was it not? It was attacked, but not rejected. And that's the interesting part of the whole deal. That people were attacking it, that people were hoping this was not the way art was going to be. And it turned out it wasn't the way art was going to be, it was the way art was. But it was other ways too at the same time. Can't get any questions out of you, can I? Oh, thank you. Did you want a June wedding or?
You said early on that you are not sure where you're going, what you're interested in.
Yeah.
You said that at the beginning of your talk. Did you feel that way at the beginning of your career? Did you feel a sense of certainty? Because your work seems very certain. It feels like you have a direction you want to go. How did that work?
It still works that way. I don't put anything out in the public. I don't put anything out that I'm not sure of. I could be wrong, but I'm not that I'm sure of. How does that work? You'll have to take the problem that we're looking at is how things entered into a culture, but you'll have to look at the culture that it entered into. If, in fact, there was a context. There was a dreadful war going on in the end of the 60s. The country was in an absolute disaster. It was a much different time than it is now. Schools were closing down, not because of economics, but because they couldn't come to a reconciliation of what it was they were supposed to be teaching. Social unstrife and social strife and such was so totally different. Now everything is really just people's opinions. And I'm at a point in my life where I would like to see art, with all of the advantages that art has right now of being part of the mainstream culture, be able to stand up and be what it is. Very much like Galileo or so must have felt, that why not just throw this into the mix and see whether it really does work. And instead, what I'm beginning to look at is a necessity at this point to step forward, not aside. So I'm just speaking now personally, but there's a problem when you get asked to go and stand in front of people and talk about things. You never really quite know how you're going to feel, and that's how I'm feeling. I don't know. I never do anything in public I'm not sure of. Only because the conversation is supposed to be about what it says, not who I am or what I'm thinking. And when you're not sure of something, then you have to engage somebody into it, and it becomes dreadful, and it doesn't work. Art is something that's lying there on the floor, and nobody has to know a damn thing about it. In talking about the Dallas Cowboys this afternoon on this interview thing, I realized that nobody coming to the Cowboy Stadium has to know anything about art. It's right there. It's up on the wall. Do they have to know when it says, you know, selling them Frankfurters? It doesn't have to. You don't have to know a thing. Everything is explicit. Good art is explicit. You can look at a Jackson Pollock and not know anything about art and know exactly what you're looking at. And if you don't have a use for it, you walk away. And a work of mine, if you don't have a use for it, you walk away. Maybe you come back another time. But it's all about a person coming to art and having a need to have another logic structure presented to them. A means and a way. So that's the best answer I can give you to your question. I hope it's an answer.
Thank you.
Oh, Michael. No, this gentleman, please.
How important is the visual element of your work, the letter shape of the fonts and the color and things like that?
Initially, I didn't think it was going to be so important, and I forgot that I had some kind of a basic craft built into me as a person. I do it as a means of trying to find a non-authoritative, extremely sensual, pretty way of putting things out. So fonts are important to me. That's why I designed the Margaret Seaworthy Gothic. And at the same time, it's just like when you dress to go out. If you were going to do something, you basically dress yourself. When you put out a work, you basically dress it. The fonts and the things have no inherent meaning. In fact, it's red as well as green as well as blue. Color has a meaning in various times, but it has no inherent meaning in an installation of mine. It's an attempt to place it within a context that the content will be seen with the least amount of problems, and not carrying with it any kind of authority or things like a Helvetica or something like that.
So you want it to be fairly invisible?
Invisible and sensual at the same time. Like Greer Garson. No, I mean that seriously. It's all of these illusions. We live in a strange kind of a world where if you're lucky, you're confronted by a Greer Garson that you don't quite realize is gorgeous. You function with it and then you turn around and you realize that it is, and it's nice when you get a font. It's like the little cartoons, and they're just they're intentionally kitchen table, but they function. And they'll function on any machine, any place. And it's a means of presenting instead of writing an essay. Michael.
As an extension of his question in regards to how do you do it, these formal issues, in these cartoons it becomes very clear that lines become very important,
yes.
Color becomes important, font becomes important. Do you do this as drawings on paper?
Mm-hmm.
Do you work on a computer at all?
No.
No, you don't have any?
No, I design occasionally a program for somebody to use, but I don't. But that's a personal thing. I was involved in the early, if you remember, with Adaweb. We did Homeport, which is still floating around somewhere. But there's nobody talking. It was a chat palace, and I have no idea how people find it or still use it, but it's there. No, that's only because otherwise I'd spend all of my time talking to people. No, email is a terror when you make your living and you do your work. In an international situation, it's much better to see it in hard copy than it is to sit down at the machine. And then I'll answer and I'll do things. But as far as these things go, I draw them. And we try... Remember, the computer is a wonderful thing because it's the least oppressive tool that we've ever found. It really doesn't care. It's just that it's been programmed because of economics not to do certain things unless you pay for them. But in fact, most of the computers can do everything. You just have to figure out how to ask it to do it without it knowing you're asking it to do it. And it does it. It's an equal opportunities employer. It's true, you know that. Sometimes you'll find yourself with a program that's not going to do it because you have to go further and get another program. But you ask it to do something that's sort of like it, and with pleasure it does it. It's not always malevolent. No, but I did draw it out. As a matter of fact, I'm going to show the drawings for this last cartoon at Marion Goodman. Yes?
You were talking earlier about language and how various words that we use for things, like stone, wood, etc., they all can look different or are different to each individual. That seems to me that it would lend itself to infinite, you know, opportunities and ways of looking at one word or a series of words. Have you ever found any limits to language that you use?
Every once in a while. And you'll be dealing with a language where it cannot accommodate the state that you're trying to deal with. It hasn't, the language itself will not accommodate, its logic will not accommodate it. It happened when I was working in Palestine. I did a book for Palestine in Arabic, Hebrew, and English. It was all about what do you do when you don't know what it is and it didn't exist before. Hebrew was even, that's a modern language, was even difficult. It didn't want to accommodate something that didn't exist before. And we had a real bitch in Arabic to make it accommodate something that didn't exist before. But that's just a glitch. And in fact, the book was more about lines and things. And for children, it was no trouble because they didn't know that they weren't supposed to be able to logically do it. I just did a children's book for UNESCO where even the translation of Give and Get in English into French, I was not going to translate it as Give and Get. I translated it as Quid Pro Quo. Donant, okay? But there are limits. But there's a limit with oil paint. There's a limit with acrylic. There's a limit with everything. There are some things you can't do with stone. And there are things I can't do with language, and that's maybe why I occasionally do a drawing, or that's why, in relation to what Michael and I were talking about, and that's occasionally why I'll make a movie, because I don't want to write an essay. I want to put it in its own context. And I always want to question, personally, what if, in fact, there is no context? Everybody thinks that that means that everything's a context, there's always a context. No, what if, in fact, there is no context? What if a human being in a studio someplace else has made something that does not yet have a use? And for me, politically, it's very important that art has some use, either as a point or as a reference or as something else. But what if, in fact, there is no context for certain things? Do we build a context to accommodate that, or do we wait? Or did somebody make a big mistake? That's basically what you're asking, I think. Each time you do something, you have to deal with it that way. Maybe you're making a big mistake. Yes, sir. The man with the green shirt. Oh, is it green? Yeah.
And I was going back to your first cartoon, and then the comparison that came through strongly was the lack of the soundtrack. And you know, the things you've said, that positions of no meaning and no context, and I must admit, in the first movie, I had a very strong sense of being kind of inserted in a kind of a Robert Altman moment. And I wondered if you could just talk about how inevitable it is that you try to find context even when you're confused and can't sort out the overlapping soundtrack.
I'm not quite sure what the question is. I know what you're saying. What you're saying is making sense as a statement.
I think that human beings are kind of conceptualizing animals.
Yes.
I think I understand.
Yeah. I like overlay soundtracks, and I like things where people pick things up here and there. But I don't think it's that they have to contextualize. They have to find a need. And the second cartoon had no need for a soundtrack because, in fact, it's a little bit of a treatise. It has no double meanings. The first one was all about an entrance into our society where there was a time when things were okay, you'd say excellent, etc. And the little drawings were little drawings. They were pictographs of flowcharts and what can be done with things. And the soundtrack of my speaking, my ethics, or whatever it is that I'm trying to say, was not trying to confuse. It was trying to place it within its own context. Second cartoon has not yet a context. We have not yet passed Marx and Engels. It's not Engels, but Marx and Engels. We have not yet taken the bagel from Hegel. Everything economically that goes on in our lives, in any system that we know, is Hegelian. And it's becoming obvious it doesn't work. It's not the system that's not working. It's the essential logic pattern that's not working. And that's what happened in art at a certain point in the late 50s. It was the logic pattern of what constituted an artist making art that no longer was working. And that changed. But the art itself didn't essentially change. Economics won't essentially change. But we have to own up to the fact that some things just don't work any longer. Maybe they'll work later. I don't know. I used to use Dr. Ehrlich's magic bullet the few times that I had to give lectures. And that's something from a Hollywood movie, and Dr. Ehrlich was a doctor living in Germany who took on the plight of people with syphilis and gonorrhea. And he invented something called Salversan with sulfur. It didn't cure it, but it stopped the spread. It stopped the deterioration. He's a hero. He's a hero for kids growing up in New York for some reason. I don't know why he wasn't ever in New York that I know of. But he became a folk hero. And it's Dr. Ehrlich's magic bullet. I think Edward G. Robinson was in the movie in Hollywood. Problem is if you got the clap, you wanted penicillin. But you didn't have to demean Ehrlich. You didn't have to demean what the person had done before. The mistake of the academic people, the sad people, I call the married people, was that they couldn't come and say, look, I've got penicillin. They had to spend all of their time saying, no, Daumier was no good. Goya was no good. Painting is no good. Sculptures, what a waste of time. All they had to do was make something that functioned and it'll stand on the same stage. And that's all anybody has to do. I see it, I perhaps 45 years ago saw it as a need for gunfighting, but because the structure was so owned by everybody, it's not any longer. It's a lot more open. This is a very wonderful time to sit down quietly and try to figure out what the making of art is all about. And I'm a lucky person, that's my profession. I can even make a living pondering what the making of art is all about every day. That's all that art is. That's all that an artist is a person who ponders about what the making of art is in light of all of the things that are going on simultaneously in the world. The reason that I don't think that art should be addressing directly, I don't do it, social issues, is that you're trying to set up a logic that makes those social issues not even possible. If there's no hierarchy within materials, if there's a simultaneity, there can't be any racism. There's no logic for it. If you can remove the logic patterns by the art of what's going on, the social issues must be taken care of. But then that becomes like Jean-Paul Sartre. He was selling Humanité in the street, and his colleagues ran up to him and said, Jean-Paul, you can't do this. You've turned down the Nobel Prize. You are the most important, famous literature in France at this moment writer. And he said, yes, so from 7 o'clock until 12 o'clock, I work on my Flaubert book, and I am better than you. Yeah, I'm great. But after 12 o'clock, I'm just a citizen, and if I want to get involved in these things, I'm doing it. Didn't have to make a pretense. It doesn't have to be a pretense. Art itself is so important. How you relate to a piece of stone in relation to a piece of wood probably will help more children survive in the next 200 years than you're standing and saying, I feel bad. I feel bad. No, you feel bad, but that has nothing to do with that piece of stone. And, yes?
Recently I was at Via Vegan.
I can't hear you, I'm sorry, sorry.
Recently I was at Via Vegan, which you have an installation there.
Yeah.
And in the installation, I was sitting with several contemporaries, and we found that the verbiage on the walls was a jumping off point for far more elaborate discussions. And I guess my question to you is, when you create your work, do you create it as a monologue between yourself and the piece, or with the byproduct of considering the the extraneous conversations that your piece will manifest?
I only show it and make it public. I don't really have the need to make a lot of things public. I only make it public so that it's not a monologue with me in the material. It's something that, because again, I've had either the luxury, or when I didn't have the possibility, I decided to take it, to work towards certain things. When I present things, I want other people to engage in it, not necessarily engage with me. If you'll notice, a lot of things I do don't have names or anything, it's just there. You can look it up in the internet all, but it's sort of there. I want what happened. What you're just telling me means, in my eyes, that whole thing of doing the deal was worth it. I mean it. And anything I show, the reason that I was so happy that it was in the cafeteria here, is nothing to do with me any longer. Yeah, of course, when my rent comes due, I want to keep saying, hey, I had something to do with it. Let's figure out something, please. But that's practical. We can't mix up the practical and the need for things. People put down a lot of younger artists and say, oh, they're just trying to be stars. No, they're trying to pay their bills. And the only way you can do it is the same as a musician or a dancer. You have to basically be that person. But that's not what you do. What you do is you put things out in the world that other people dance to.
Could you talk about your books in that light, putting things out in the world?
I like books, because you can draw them and they can contain things. And I'm a little frightened. I was frightened from McLuhan days about media being the thing. They can always turn off the electric. If they turn off the electric, you don't have a computer. They turn off the electric, you don't have a TV. But for some strange reason, books, no matter what various cultures have done to people, books turn up under beds, in bathrooms. They sort of continue to survive. And that's one of the reasons. It's also a very sensual thing. Kindle is fine. But if you can't get a battery, you can't read it. With a book, all you need to do is wait until the sun comes up in the morning. It's that simple. It's purely pragmatic on my thing. I also happen to like the new, with the computers, with the new printing presses. You could do anything you want without it costing a fortune for anybody. And you can just, the UNESCO book that I've been working on is, we're going to print it just as a standard format from a French children's book, using the same shiny paper. And my contention is that it doesn't have to be plasticized. Paper lasts. And if it doesn't, if somebody uses it to wipe their ass, or somebody uses it to start a fire, maybe it was important to wipe your ass or start a fire. You can't fetishize all these things. But I like books.
Okay. I think we use that.
Yes. Excuse me.
Go right ahead.
Yeah.
Is it important to you, the label conceptual artist, and does that inform what you do and how you talk about the things that you do?
Yeah, very important. I hate it. I think it's the stupidest thing that was ever done. I only have one child. And, I mean, as a conceptual artist, I didn't do so good. I mean, I don't know where it came from, but I had a theory years ago, and it was that a lot of artists, because we were all doing something that nobody knew what to do with, a lot of them got nervous and they figured they're going to teach. If they're going to teach, they'd have to be in some department. And they'd have to have a department, so they'd have the Department of Conceptual Art. I don't know what it means. I never did. But it really is like action painting. It's like, I have no, there's not, it's not worth arguing about. If you notice, I didn't pick up on it earlier. I just let it go. But I absolutely think it's asinine. Yes.
Hi. I'm struggling for finding the usefulness wrestling with the idea of being or making something that's useful. And the thing that's come to my mind is kind of like a burst, and I wonder if you could comment on it. I think of the older Yeats, specifically, say, Sailing to Byzantium. Are you familiar?
Yeah.
With that poem?
Yeah.
Where the older poet.
The Byzantium poem, yes.
Yeah. Is there something to that, or is it just?
You know, that's a funny thing, because it's really strange that you would bring this up, because I was talking with my grandson, who doesn't have any idea what I'm talking about most of the time, because he's only 5 and a half, and realized that, no, things that were important to me are like Olsen, and things like that in my development as a human being, don't have a real context any longer unless I'm in an extremely romantic mood. Yeats is useful to me if I can associate not with an empire as Yeats did, but I can associate with the people I developed around from the Beat times and all of this. But it's romantic. And I don't think I'm a romantic person any longer. And I think that the Byzantium issue is a relationship to civilizations that I don't know. Maybe we're the first group of people in a long time that don't even think we're civilized. I make a work of art to deal with problems of the day with other people and show it to other people and hope that it will lead to them looking at their life. But it certainly ain't from associating with what I consider this great panoply of civilization. I used to say that art was something that entered in to the society, and it banged around. It had no place to go. It didn't know what it didn't have any place. So it broke this, it hit this. That's all fine. That was part of its anger, its non-macho anger. And then it eventually laid down on this table that was art history, that was the accomplishments of everybody else. Sounds great, but I don't know. I don't associate any longer personally. And a lot of artists I know don't. Really and truly, the people in this room at this moment might be the only people that count about what we're doing. And then the next room and the next room and the next room. Because it's all about that. I'm sorry, I can't see it. I know what you're trying to lead to, and I even think that it's quite gracious of you. But I don't want to associate with the history of art at this moment. I want people to be able to look at what's being done without having to know the history, and then later learn the history. I don't want the history to disappear. I like the fact that I'm reasonably well-educated, so I would imagine anybody else would like the fact of being reasonably well-educated. That's it. Well, I think we've reached our point. Thank you very much for your patience. It must be very difficult to watch somebody try very hard to place what it is they're trying to say in a situation where everybody's supposed to know exactly what they're going to say.